Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Next week is American Education Week, and yesterday we started a conversation touching on just a few of the challenges facing schools and educators. There are many of them, so we continue our discussion today. In fact, just in the half hour we have today, the half hour we had yesterday, we could probably talk about another 30 or, I don't know, even more than that, but we're just going to focus on a few today. Joining us again today, Jeff Nye, who is with the Pennsylvania State Education Association. He is the treasurer of PSEA. Jeff, welcome back to the program.
Oh, glad to be back, Scott. Thanks.
Also, Ronald Cow from the Education Policy and Leadership Center. Mr. Cow, welcome to the show as well.
Good to be with you.
1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. We had a lot of calls on hold yesterday when we went off the air. So if you were tuning in yesterday, wanted to get your question in or your comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Yesterday, we spent almost the entirety of the segment of the program talking about a teacher shortage throughout Pennsylvania. And I'm going to start today, but for those who may not have tuned in yesterday, just to kind of bring them up to speed, Jeff Nye, let's talk about this briefly, if you can, just to provide some background, what kind of teacher shortage we're looking at here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, absolutely. Over the past 5 years, we've seen a reduction almost by two-thirds of the certification that are being handed out in Pennsylvania. We just don't have the people going into education like we have in the past.
And we pointed to one of the reasons as being the salaries. There was a statistic that we had yesterday that found that Pennsylvania's teachers, this is from the Economic Policy Institute from this February, found that Pennsylvania teachers are undercompensated and may be the reason why there is a shortage. You mentioned that there are some places where teachers are starting at $18,200 a year. I had an emailer here ask, where are those places? What are some of the school districts?
The school districts are in the central western part of the state, more of a very rural. Way back when, $18,500 was the absolute minimum that you can pay a teacher, and that was passed back in the 80s, and since then it's never changed. We believe it's very crucial right now to change that, and there should be a minimum salary for teachers that go into the profession today.
What should that minimum be?
We believe that minimum should be about $45,000.
Going from 18 to 45,000. But just, and I had a caller here who asked this question, can you name one of the districts that, just to kind of put a name on one of these districts that is paying that?
Unfortunately, I don't have the names with me.
Ron Cow, do you know of any that are starting at that salary?
No, I don't. To be fair, Jeff just mentioned, that figure is embedded in state law. It's been there at that, I think it's $18,500 as a minimum salary for probably 30 years now, and the legislature has never updated it. Fortunately, I think we got to be careful we don't scare off young people who might be thinking about entering the profession. Fortunately, I don't think there's any school district that I'm aware of that's starting at $18,500 now. I think the reality is most of them are starting somewhere in the low 30s or much more generous in more wealthy districts.
Okay, so I just wanted to...
Which is one of the big problems, this tremendous disparity between the have and the have-not districts in terms of what they're able to offer a young person coming into the profession.
Okay, I just want to make sure that I clarified that, because that's kind of misleading when we say that even though law says $18,500, that there are no school districts that are paying that across the state. I don't know. Jeff, you disagree?
Oh, yes. There are. I don't have the names of those school districts right off the bat, but we do in our system. We have not many. The number is small, but there are some teachers out there that are starting their careers making $18,500.
Mm. Okay, so let me follow up with a couple of emails from yesterday. Bill writes, troubled that college enrollment in majors leading to teaching degrees is half what it was 5 or 10 years ago. I'd like to hear more about the supply-demand issues in teaching today. 5, 10 years ago, I knew a number of young people, mostly women with elementary ed degree certifications, who could not find a teaching job in their field. Shocked to hear there are districts paying $18,000. We just addressed that. It'd be helpful to know where in Pennsylvania the situation exists. Talked about that. Also shocked to learn that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania ranks 47th in the country on the percentage of funding that the state provides to school districts. Would like to know the source of the statistic. I think that was a statistic that you had yesterday, Ron. So where does that stat come from?
Bottom five, 47th, 46th. People get into big debates about whether we're 46th or 47th or 48th. We're in the bottom. That's the point that lawmakers need to understand. And those numbers come from the U.S. Census Bureau and also from the National Center for Education Statistics, that is a part of the U.S. Department of Education.
Okay.
All of those statistics come from those two sources.
We have an email here from Lisa. Says, was mentioned on yesterday's show, the difference in funding of education between Pennsylvania and other states. What was mentioned on was how Pennsylvania differs from other states, that is, the reliance on property taxes. But what never seems to be mentioned is how exactly other states are paying for education. It would be beneficial to listeners to hear, for example, exactly how other states fund education. This is a separate tax, part of normal state budget? What percentage of the state pays versus locals? So, Ron, let me ask you about that. What do other states do?
States typically rely on broad-based taxes. One of them that some states use that we do not in Pennsylvania is a property tax. State lawmakers, and I agree with this, state lawmakers leave the property tax as a tool for local government, including school districts and municipalities and counties. Beyond that, other states use one of three broad taxes typically, business taxes, income taxes, or sales taxes. And usually it's a combination of those. And in most places, there's not a tax that is dedicated. Technically in Pennsylvania, the sales tax, when it was first put into place, was dedicated as an education tax. Now, we're far beyond that. But in summary, other states rely on statewide property taxes, and or income tax, sales tax, business tax.
Where does Pennsylvania rank as far as, and I'm not going to ask for an exact number, but generally, where does Pennsylvania rank when it comes to property taxes? I know New Jersey is very high.
Well, I mentioned yesterday that in terms of our dependency on property taxes in Pennsylvania to support schools, more than 45% of K-12 money comes from property taxes to support schools. Nationally, the average is less than 30%. So we rank very high in terms of our dependency on property taxes. And again, that's a direct result of the legislature, as I said yesterday, it sounds harsh, but it's a fact, the legislature is cheap or stingy about supporting K-12 education. And the view generally in Harrisburg has been leave it to local folks to get the political heat, first of all, and to make decisions about how much money they want to raise. And so when you leave it to the locals in a disproportionate way, that usually means higher property taxes.
I guess I was looking at it from the angle of taxpayers as far as the average amount that a homeowner or a property owner pays.
I don't know that number statewide in comparison to other states. And again, within Pennsylvania, it varies tremendously. You know, you probably know well, Scott, I think you've talked about it on your programs in years past. We've got a county-based system of assessment, and so the assessment system is part of the problem that we have in Pennsylvania, too. Generally speaking, folks who live in relatively wealthy communities where there's a big tax base, maybe shopping centers, maybe research centers, a lot of industry, a lot of retail, and wealthy homeowners, or let me say expensive homes, their rate often is less, although their tax bill may be more. And in contrast, you have poor communities where there's hardly any tax base. They may have a very high rate, but they're not generating much income to support local government and or school district. Mm.
We have an email from Jim who asks, can your guest please talk about the hierarchy of school systems, such as superintendents, assistant superintendents, other high-level administrators and principals? I believe many of these positions pay well over $100,000 a year and have an impact on the cost of public education. This is one that I know you probably don't want to touch, Jeff, but and by the way, I'm going to mention that we are part of WITS PA Post. We have a story coming up, an investigation into hierarchy, as it's called in this email of salaries and perks for superintendents and others out there. But let me just ask you this part of the question, Jeff. And, I mean, you can answer it if you want, but has PSEA ever taken a position on salaries, level of salaries for superintendents, others in the hierarchy of school districts?
No, we've never established anything like that. PSEA does actually represent certain parts of administration if they choose to get organized under the umbrella of PSEA. So we do have a little bit of information on some administration out there. The superintendents and assistant superintendents, that's well beyond what we...
I think probably part of that conversation always is that there are areas where spending can be controlled. And I know that, you know, from talking to people in education, you know, Jeff, you and I were just having this discussion, or we were just having this discussion before we went on the air, that with this issue, and it's one of the reasons we decided to continue the conversation from yesterday, it is not just this or just that. One thing, two things you can point a finger to and say, well, if we just did this, test scores would go up, kids would be better educated, teachers would be paid fairly, property taxes would level off. This is a complicated issue. And let's face it, anything as big as a school district or education across the state of Pennsylvania with as much money, yes, you obviously can find places where spending can be cut, could be controlled, but you have to look at a district's priorities and the state's priorities. Ron, would you like to weigh in on that?
Well, to begin with the issue of salaries for superintendents, school boards, except in Philadelphia, our school boards are elected, first of all. So they are representative of communities, you know, they're not there to make arbitrary and outlandish decisions in terms of what they pay folks. One of the most important jobs, or one of the most important roles of a school board, is to hire the best superintendent they can find and afford, and to treat that person as the CEO, just like you're looking for a CEO for a business. And a lot of our school districts are $25, $50, $100 million enterprises. And so there's nothing outlandish about paying the CEO for that $50 or $100 million business $150,000 a year. In fact, in a competitive environment, school boards find it necessary to do that. There really is a shortage in terms of the pipeline of folks moving up who not only are ready to be superintendents, but who want to be superintendents with all the headaches that are associated with that position. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I do agree that there are ways to consider saving money, but some of them are not terribly popular. You know, you look around and, again, I'm all for athletics at the high school level. I have a grandson who plays high school ball. But what some school districts spend on athletic facilities far exceed any consideration of what they're paying teachers or what they're paying the superintendent. So as you suggested earlier, it is a matter of priorities on the part of a school board, but at the end of the day, it's a matter of priorities for the community. And the third point I'd make is that we ought to be looking around for ways to do some consolidating. Now, it's not popular at all to suggest that we ought to consolidate school districts. I think it's outlandish that we have 500 school districts in Pennsylvania, that in Allegheny County, where I spent most of my life, we have 43 school districts, pockets of poverty sitting beside a pocket of wealth. But the idea of structurally changing this 500 school district map is not popular in the legislature, and frankly, is not popular in a lot of communities as well. So what we ought to be doing that is much more practical is looking for ways for what I'll call functional consolidation, where two or more school districts can work together to achieve cost savings. And a lot of that is going on, often through intermediate units, but often through other collaborations as well. But they collaborate around some of the business functions. They collaborate sometimes around transportation issues. They collaborate sometimes around human resource issues. I think particularly on the transportation issue. If we could get school districts to work more closely together, and they have to work with the non-public school community as well because of what the state law is, there are tens of millions of dollars that could probably be saved for education if we did a better job on the transportation side.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're continuing the conversation we started yesterday about education here in Pennsylvania. And just to let someone know, if you're just tuning in, let everyone know that obviously we're not going to be able to cover all the issues. I don't know if you could list all the issues that relate to education in Pennsylvania. So we're just touching on a few. But we do want to hear from you. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Our guest today, Ronald Cowell. He is from the Education Policy and Leadership Center, and Jeff Nye, Pennsylvania State Education Association. 1-800-729-7532. Elaine wrote in just to kind of give us a timeline here. She said, I started teaching for Intermediate Unit 13 in 1983 for $13,500. So the state required $18,500 salary. It went into effect sometime after that. So that kind of gives us at least the starting point, a timeline then. A couple things that have happened here legislatively just in the recent past. School districts must now provide a public review, identify cost, and hold a public hearing prior to the subcontracting of services or positions. Teachers won't be furloughed just because they teach in an area that the district intends to cut. In other words, a subject area. Keystones became a graduation requirement. That's Keystone testing. Became a graduation requirement for the 2020-2021 school year. Lead testing in schools to keep drinking water safe. That's something that's new. Vocation certification change that helps attract and retain quality career and tech educators by lessening the burdensome certification process currently required. Jeff Nye, those are changes. A lot of them do involve teachers. So your thoughts, PSEA's thoughts on those issues?
Well, obviously, when it comes to public review and to make sure that the community is involved in a lot of the cuts that are happening in our schools, I mean, that is. I mean, we have to understand that in Pennsylvania, from whatever corner that you live in, the number one resource you have in your communities is the children, because that's where Pennsylvania is going to move forward. And to make sure that we're giving those kids the best education possible should be our number one goal always. When you start cutting certain programs just because it makes, well, financing easier, we're just going to cut this part out, it is not what is in the best interest for our schools, for our communities, and for the future of those kids. As far as some of the other things, we are so happy that the standardized testing has been reduced. As far as the PSSAs are considered, we dropped those by almost a week. The time that is taken in our classrooms and what the students and the teachers go through to get them ready for the tests is just not, again, not in the best interest of the education policy that we should have. And then the last option, the last question you had with the Keystones, we are absolutely overjoyed that the governor and the legislature gave us different avenues in which students can have those graduation requirements. They don't have to fit into this nice little neat box. They do have different ways that they can achieve those education and graduation requirements. And we are so happy that the legislature voted and approved that and signed that into law.
I heard criticisms from every corner of education about the PSSAs of teaching to the test, that there was a lot of pressure on teachers, a lot of pressure on school districts, but probably the most pressure on the students themselves. And so I guess what I'm asking is, with these Keystone exams, still a standardized test, will there be teaching, or has been reduced teaching to the test, just so students can pass those tests to graduate?
If a student chooses that path, or if that is what they do, there will be a test for that student. But, like I said, there now is going to be other avenues in which they can achieve what needs to be done as far as graduation requirements. PSEA has been working with the legislature, and it was unanimously approved by everybody, and the governor signed it into law so that there are different avenues, so it doesn't have to be pass the test.
All right, let's take a phone call from Jessica in Carlisle. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was a science teacher for 5 years and got out of it because of the Keystone testing. I don't think anybody can truly understand how difficult it is to be a teacher unless you're sitting in the classroom with these students. I taught biology, chemistry, but the biology Keystone made students who weren't able to pass this test, that's the only science they were able to take until they graduated, because you had to do remediation. You were in your biology classes specifically teaching for the test, and it took some of the joy out of the teaching, and it took a lot of pressure for myself and for the students to be able to pass this test.
When you say it took some of the joy, tell us about that joy and why it took some of the joy away.
Well, I didn't design the test. If I were to have designed it, I probably wouldn't have put the specific things on the test that they have put on there. Some of the questions that I was able to view from the students were incorrect. It's not necessarily the subjects that the students would need. I believe that there should be standards for students to graduate, but I feel like a lot of the biology things that students would need, such as, like, how do you measure your child's medicine so that they, you know, will get a correct dose, things like that that everyone should probably know when they leave school. Those kinds of things are put on the wayside because you're studying topics that a student probably would never need.
Mm. Hey, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead.
An additional perspective. I don't disagree at all with what your caller just said. The fact is, the Keystone exams are not irrelevant, but less relevant because the link to graduation requirement has largely been removed by the legislature now. So the two big questions for policymakers at the state and local level, as well as anybody else who's concerned about education, the two big questions do remain. One, what kind of accountability do we want to have in this system? Everybody is for accountability, but folks get a little squeamish when we end up dealing with the consequences that get attached to the accountability. And we've been a whole lot better at holding kids accountable than anybody else, including the state policymakers. So, you know, that large question of how are we going to build accountability into the system, for whom and for what? And then the second thing that needs to be underscored, you know, we've got an election today, but in a few weeks, school board elections are going to start for 2019. Those are, in my opinion, some of the most important positions and thankless positions in the entire state. They get paid nothing. They put many, many hours and days into their work. I said earlier that one of the most important decisions they make is hiring the CEO, hiring the superintendent. I also think that one of the most important decisions they make, even in this state where there are some state requirements, is what are the graduation requirements in that school district. It really is the school board that gets to decide what are the graduation requirements, what that piece of paper, that diploma, is actually worth in that community. And we got to pay more attention to that, especially in an environment where the legislature is now giving more latitude to school boards.
We have some callers and some emails here, and I really appreciate that the audience is doing some fact-checking for us and sending in some information. Harris in Harrisburg says, worked with the Pennsylvania Department of Education, has a publication online that has salaries, professional status figures. It shows salaries. He sees several districts that do pay $18,500. It mentions New Kensington in Western Pennsylvania, and surprisingly, Central Bucks, which I find hard to believe. I mean, I'm not questioning Harris, but Central Bucks, which seems to me to be one of the richest school districts, or at least in southeastern Pennsylvania, I don't know. That just doesn't sound right, but that's the figures that he's showing. Mary from Lancaster says, is reason for low funding for education because of one party does not want educated electorate? Well, that's kind of a political question, but let me ask this, Ron. You were in the legislature. How much does politics play into education funding, education overall?
Well, I don't think that it is accurate to suggest that it's partisan politics in a complete sense. Although there are significant differences, in my opinion, there are significant differences between the positions that have been taken in the last 10 years or so by Republican and Democratic parties. It was under Governor Corbett. These are just facts. It was under Governor Corbett and a Republican legislature that school districts lost $854 million in state support in 2011. They opened, and people debate whether it was stimulus money and all that, but when school districts opened their doors in September of 2011, they had $854 million less to support students than they did the year before. That resulted in some 20,000 furloughs. It resulted in some 10,000 furloughs of teachers. And if you don't count the pension money that has been put in, and Governor Wolf has been working hard, I think, to restore that money, but if you don't count the pension money, that $854 million has not been completely restored.
Can I interrupt for one? Ron, can I interrupt for just...
But let me finish the point.
Okay.
I said you can't reduce it to just partisan politics. Because there have been years when the governor was a Democrat with a Democrat legislature as well, even during my time there. You know, I was happy that I've been out for 20 years now, so this is a history story. But during much of that time, we had governors who were Republican and Democrat and legislatures that were Republican and Democrat that did prioritize increases. And when I was there, a Republican or Democrat governor would propose an increase, and the legislature, whether it was Republican or Democrat, would go beyond that. But in recent years, for those who advocate for more education funding, it's been a defensive battle. When Governor Wolf proposed some increases over the last 3 years, the advocacy community was fighting to get the legislature to not cut that. And in many cases, they actually did cut it a bit. So, again, lots of dirty hands, though. This problem of poor or inadequate state funding is a historical problem, not one that is only reduced to what has happened in the last 10 years, although the last 10 years have made it far worse.
I guess what I was going to say is that, yeah, there are debates about whether that was stimulus money, but it actually was, but the money wasn't replaced. It has been replaced now under the Wolf administration. Amy in Hummelstown says, we should take a whole look at schools, starting at the principal on up to administrators, and possibly some of those positions could be regionalized. And I think she means what we were talking about earlier. What do you think about that?
Well, to have a regionalized school district would definitely be one of those concepts, but we're back into that conversation where if we just do this, we can fix all of the ails that hit education. There are so many other factors that go into play. I come from a district up in the Northeast, the Wilkes-Barre Area School District, and right now we are actually consolidating. We have three independent high schools, and we're actually consolidating into one high school. It did not happen overnight. It was something that has been talked about probably over the past 12 to 15 years, and finally it is one of those things that's coming. They're starting with the sports teams, and they're going to end up with the education.
That was my question, because this, whether, you know, people look at if their priorities are straight or not, sports teams, one of the reasons that a lot of districts, a lot of local people don't want to consolidate. How did they do that?
So what our district decided to do is, while the construction is going to be going on, because the construction is not going to be done for another 4 to 5 years, they are starting to get the students to start collaborating with each other and work together in those different teams and start condensing those teams into one and have fly under one banner in the Wilkes-Barre Area School District.
What's the name of the team?
The new name of the team is going to be the Wilkes-Barre Area Wolfpack.
Wolfpack, okay.
John, there used to be a research director for School Boards Association. And he used to rhetorically ask the question, what's the toughest animal to kill in Pennsylvania? And the answer was the school mascot.
Yeah.
this matter of consolidating, whether it's within a district or between districts or among districts, is not only a matter of good decision-making by those who have that authority, but it's also a matter of public sentiment. And public sentiment so frequently runs against any kind of consolidation that makes it difficult for school board members and other policymakers who want to make the tough decisions to actually do that.
And it's one of the reasons that here in Pennsylvania we have 2,500 municipalities too. I mean, you could make that comparison. In the school district, it may be even more of an emotional attachment than, say, your local municipality, but 500 school districts, 2,500 municipalities. I'm curious, we're not talking about consolidating school districts, though, Jeff. We're talking about one district, three high schools, right?
Correct. That is correct.
Okay. And actually, that goes opposite of what many districts are doing as populations continue to rise. I think of Downingtown in Chester County or Central Bucks in Bucks County, where there used to be one high school, now there are three. And
We're getting back into the topic where the Wilkes-Barre School District saw the need for funding, and the funding just was not there. They did not have the tax base. It is a community that is largely filled with colleges who do not kick in for their taxes. So the tax base just kind of evaporated over time. So they needed to do something. Plus, I mean, there are those people that move in, move out of a district and the consolidation. But you're right. I mean, people in a community, they have that belonging to their area. Their parents graduated from there. Their grandparents graduated from there. And they don't want to give up that identity. And that's a very, very difficult concept to get anybody to sign on to.
Well, and even it goes down to the elementary school level. I mean, let's face it, even within a school district, there are population changes. There may be a new neighborhood, a new housing development that goes up, and that increases the population. But you still hear parents say, I want my child that started in first and second grade at this elementary school to stay there and not have to move across town. And, you know, transportation issues come up too. You know, gentlemen, we're out of time again for today's program, but I think, you know, we touched on a lot of issues. Education is obviously something we have to talk a whole lot about here in the future, but thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Having us.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, yes, it is Election Day, and I encourage everyone to get out and vote today. If it's raining, I always wondered about that excuse that, oh, the weather was bad. It's raining, folks. This is an important election. They all are important. We were just talking about school boards. Probably one of those areas that people know the least about, but we're not voting for school board members this year, but some very important offices, so do get out and vote. Even if it's raining hard, use an umbrella, get out and vote today. But we'll have analysis of the election coming up on tomorrow's show. In 2014, WITF set out to produce a documentary that would chronicle the rise and fall of institutionalized care for people with intellectual disability in Pennsylvania. In 2016, we premiered I Go Home, which aired on PBS stations in Pennsylvania and across the nation. It is still widely used as a teaching tool across the state and the country. Now in 2018, WITF is preparing for the broadcast premiere of Going Home, a follow-up documentary to 2016's I Go Home. Going Home airs on WITF-TV Thursday night at 8. Joining us today is Kira McGuire. She's the producer of Going Home, and disability advocate Dr. Dennis Downey. He's professor emeritus of history at Millersville University and has been a guest on our program several times. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
If you have a question or a comment about Going Home, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, a question or comment about Going Home or intellectual disability, and nowadays, the people who are living with an intellectual disability, how they are included in the community. There are a lot of issues having to do with this. 1-800-729-7532. So, Kieran, let me start with you, and we'll talk about the production. Talk about the production of this documentary, how it came to be.
Right, Scott. So as you mentioned, we produced I Go Home a few years back, and that really brought us up to present day. So WITF is all about education, and we wanted to further the education surrounding intellectual disability and life for those living with intellectual disability, as you mentioned. And there's a lot left to still talk about when we talk about that. Over 30 on-camera interviews were conducted for this documentary alone, for this new one, Going Home. And so many more conversations were had off-camera and over the phone. You know, so many people shared their life stories and their perspective with me in production of this documentary. We got to know gentlemen who were leaving a state center that closed earlier this year, Hamburg State Center. We spent days with them. They lived decades in Hamburg Center, and we got to spend time with them and spend time with the staff there at Hamburg. We also spent time in a day program and a sheltered workshop, which is something that a lot of people experience in today's world with intellectual disability. We spent time with an inclusive university program, getting to know the difference that has made in the lives of those who attend. And it all kind of resulted in what will premiere as Going Home.
I Go Home, the documentary that was produced and aired, I should say, in 2016, started at Pennhurst. Dennis Downey, for those who may not be familiar, and I encourage everyone, you can see it online, of I Go Home, but it started at Pennhurst. Kind of give us some background, some history of the Pennhurst. Was it a hospital? Was it referred to as Pennhurst Hospital?
Well, eventually, its name became the Pennhurst State School and Hospital.
Okay, okay.
It began in 1908 as the Eastern Pennsylvania State Institution for the Feeble-Minded and Epileptic.
Oh, so they got more sensitive, huh?
More sensitive. The nature of the institution evolved, the name evolved, and controversy evolved over the 20th century. And it really is the Pennhurst case, or cases from Pennhurst, that drove litigation and advocacy that transformed public policy in Pennsylvania and around the country.
And many of our listeners, I know, saw I Go Home, and it was just a fantastic documentary. But the conditions at Pennhurst, describe them, because we think about them today. They were just horrific.
Well, they were. You may think of Pennhurst as initially a model institution, but for many of the residents, it became a nightmare. Bill Baldini's 1968 documentary, or five-part news report, Suffer the Little Children, which we talked about.
Yeah, Bill Baldini was a reporter in Philadelphia, TV reporter in Philadelphia, and had video of a lot of these conditions at Pennhurst.
That's right. He was given access to the institution, and for five nights broadcast what he heard, saw, and what people told him. And behind closed doors, there was another world than that people rarely saw, and there was abuse, experimentation, neglect, medical malpractice, and there was a chronic overcrowding, understaffing, that led to a series of just horrific developments, and that played into deinstitutionalization and the movement of people back into the homes.
And I have a clip here from Going Home, the new documentary. I want to play this for you and have you talk about what this gentleman's discussing.
Attitudes of the past went all the way from killing right at birth to treating people as a holy innocent, that God cursed the child and we had to take care of that child. The demeaning, degrading attitudes that people with disabilities are less than human, that they're not fit to be with us.
Attitudes were that people needed to be kept away from society at large, and the further away, the better.
There was a lot of words that people used. Retarded, stupid, that you'll never amount to anything.
Kier, what did we just hear there?
So you're hearing comments from a few people interviewed as part of Going Home and describing the attitudes towards people with intellectual disability, back in the day of institutionalized care. And, You know, that's why we felt it was important to talk to people today about these attitudes. Have they changed? And what I found in producing the documentary is many people share with me that they still feel separated from the community that surrounds them. They feel judged or looked down upon when they go into the community if they're living with a disability. And so it shows that we still do have a long way to go.
That is hard to hear.
It is.
It is really, really hard to hear that. I mean, this wasn't really that long ago when you were talking, Dennis, about Bill Baldini. That was
1968.
Early, yeah, late 60s. Yeah, so just 50 years ago, yeah. And many of those people probably are still living today. How far have we come from the days of Pennhurst, Dennis?
Well, I think that's the critical question. It's the question that the documentary brings up. As much as there has been a transformation or even revolution in public policy and supports and services, there are enormous challenges that still need to be confronted. Families and individuals face enormous challenges just to fit in, to be accepted, and to have the kind of basic opportunities that many of us just take for granted. So it's not a best of times, worst of times situation, but what we realize is that as important as it was to move people out of institutions back into community and family settings, that created its own problems, its own opportunities, and its own obstacles to individual and social success.
Kira, does everyone with an intellectual disability have access to an everyday life today, a life that any of us would want?
Right. You know, in production of this documentary, my discovery was that life for those with disability really varies. There are some people that never step foot into a workshop or a day program and spend all of their time with family or working in a job that they want and with hanging out with friends, while others are still spending their days surrounded by paid staff members and maybe not communicating with those in the community surrounding them, just spending their days with others with disability or with paid staff members. So, we have many obstacles still ahead. A lot of people with disability are participating in these sheltered workshops where they're earning less than minimum wage. According to data from the Independent Monitoring for Quality, less than 15% of people are engaged in community-based integrated work earning at least a minimum wage. So that's just one struggle that right there.
15% earning 15%. Minimum wage. Why do you never hear about that?
Well, that is a reason. I don't know why, but that's a reason why we're tackling it here at WITF and trying
to
shed light.
You have a look on your face like you have an answer to that.
Well, I smiled because I said to Kira just before we came in your really informed discussion of education this morning, we really didn't touch on the topic of special education, post-secondary
right.
education, vocational education. We tend to take things for granted. And we take things for granted at the expense of other human beings and the opportunities that we just assume are there for everyone. It takes vigilance and it takes advocacy, and the documentary speaks to all of that. Enormous courage just to get through the day.
As I said, during that portion of the program, there were so many issues having to do with education. We actually addressed that issue of people living with an intellectual disability and how much they are paid. And I remember, actually, I think 15% is higher than it may have gone up. Is there any movement, Dennis, maybe you're familiar with this, any movement in the legislature? Is it even on anyone's radar that only 15% of people with intellectual disability are earning minimum wage?
Well, I think it is on the radar, and one of the great but unknown policy discussions is what do we do with sheltered workshops? There's a very strong movement to close them. And if you close sheltered workshops, where will people go? How will they make what we call a living wage? How can they imagine a future if you have no place to go? So that's one small example. Another piece of it is vocational education. To what kind of life can we and should we be preparing people for? We talk about independence and self-reliance. that can't just be a tagline. What's the kind of policy development that needs to be put in place to assure that people have the skills and the opportunity and acceptance to work in the workplace?
And here's something along those lines. There's new regulations that will get people with intellectual disability who participate in day programs out in the community in small groups more often. Why is it important, mm-hmm. Kira?
It is very important because if you think about it, you know, somebody especially who has been kind of in a sheltered environment for a long time and hasn't had the opportunity to experience a different job or a different type of food or a different experience in general, how do you know what you want unless you have the opportunity to experience it? As one woman says in the documentary, how do you know if you like orange juice unless you've had a chance to take a sip of the orange juice? So those regulations will help to allow people with intellectual disability who are typically spending their days in sheltered environments to get out and experience other things.
Are employers hesitant to hire people living with an intellectual disability?
Yes. I think it varies, and you can't generalize. But oftentimes, employers, like other members of society, don't know what to do, how to react. They don't know how to see the potential that someone brings, what they can learn from employing someone who has an intellectual or other disability. And so we oftentimes take the road of least resistance, and we follow the hiring employment practices that we're most familiar with, most comfortable with. And I think one of the things that the documentary brings out, particularly in looking at post-secondary inclusive education, is that with the right kind of resources and supports, we can reimagine a future, and people can reimagine a future for themselves. But it takes a lot of work, and it takes a policy commitment in order for that to happen.
There are different levels of disabilities. Are there those who just cannot work, could not hold a job?
Well, I'll give you a personal example. We have a son who just turned 28. Thomas has complex multiple disabilities, and we've talked about Thomas before. He could never be independent, per se, as we think about it, but he has a series of volunteer jobs in the community where he makes a contribution, and he receives in return benefit. It is a social experience. It's a community experience. He's not necessarily earning a wage, but he's making a contribution through these kinds of community services. So sometimes we have to look beyond the wage structure to assess the relative support of employment opportunities. And Thomas has taught us a lot, and I can't put a price tag on that.
Mm. We only have a couple minutes left, and we won't be able to take any phone calls during those 2 minutes. What needs to change to make everyday lives a reality for all?
I think there's still so many changes that need to take place. I would say the strongest thing that stood out to me in production of both of these documentaries is the need for relationship, is the need for relationships between people with disability and people without disability. It's just seems to be the strongest message that comes out in each one of my interviews, and kind of not making assumptions about people. I can't tell you how many times I interview somebody, a family member of somebody with intellectual disability, in addition to interviewing the person with intellectual disability, but the family member will say to me, I can't tell you how many times I go to a restaurant and they ask me what my loved one wants to eat, or they ask me, and so they find the need to almost look down at the floor to make sure that the conversation can be had between the other individual and the person with intellectual disability. So just kind of a need for consciousness raising. We need to think more about opening our eyes to that.
Dennis, we only have about 30 seconds left. What should the future look like for people with disability?
Whatever you'd like. Whatever they would like. They are fellow human beings and citizens who had the same protections under the law. It's our challenge to give them the same opportunities to experience the successes that we express, that we experience on their own terms.
Dennis Downey is he's a disability advocate and also a professor emeritus of history at Millersville University. Kira McGuire is the producer of Going Home. Going Home airs on WITF-TV Thursday night at 8 o'clock, so be sure to tune in. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks,
thank
Scott.
You.
And again, I'll make one more pitch. It is Election Day. Go out and vote. Tomorrow, on tomorrow's program, we will provide analysis of the results of the election, so be sure to tune in.